Hello, Adam Peacock here. Welcome to a special series of Fox Football Podcasts. We've got to do something with our spare time in the off-season, much of which can be spent overthinking the state of football in Australia, good, bad, indifferent. So why not talk about it? This series is about who we'll be talking about in 5, 10, 15 years and beyond, the youth players of today and tomorrow, the what and the how, the what and how we make sure they end up the players we worship at World Cups. The four guests have differing roles in football today. We'll hear from Tony Vidmar, coach of the Joeys, Ian Crook, technical director of the Western Sydney Wanderers Academy, Ron Smith, who was at the AIS when the AIS was great, when the greats passed through during the 90s, but first, an in-house expert here at Fox Sports, a man who excelled as a young player here before moving abroad for a very successful career, predominantly in Germany. He now works with us as a commentator. He's a leading figure of thought on Twitter. He loves nothing more than a Tim Tam while watching good football. Thanks to a bit of individual brilliance, he is Ned Zelich. But Ned, you're the guinea pig in all of this, so welcome. How are you?
Good, mate. Self?
Yeah, good, good. What's your overriding sense of where our youth development is going at the moment?
You have to look at how this discussion has come about. I mean, clearly, the fact that that our underage teams have been struggling and haven't been qualifying for tournaments, not just the fact that we're missing out. I mean, that can happen, that the teams miss out on qualification. But the fact that we're just not even close to qualifying, we're not even getting past those initial stages. So clearly, there is a lot of concern there, and a big discussion has taken place on what is going wrong. Now, the thing is, the fact that this country has produced world-class players in the past, and that's sort of not happening right now, is another thing too. So you've got to look at clearly what's happened with the curriculum. Now, I'm someone that really does believe that there are good things to pick out of the curriculum, especially for a lot of parents that are coaching that maybe that need help to put exercises into training sessions and all the rest. But I believe as well that there's been a bit of an overemphasis of what this curriculum can actually do for this country and the players that we produce. So I still believe it comes down to what I think is hugely important. And we had Tom Beyer on Shootout a few weeks ago, and something that I completely agree with him is we have to start teaching kids a lot earlier to basically be technically better, to correct mistakes. I feel that a lot more coaching has to go into those younger age groups. Now, at the moment, that's not the case. Yeah. It's basically a situation where go out, have fun, there's no league tables, there's no pressure, and then when you're 12, 13, that's when we'll start working with you. And in my opinion, that's way too late.
When you grew up, you had not huge pressure. It wasn't World Cup finals, but as a kid, I guess it does feel a bit like a World Cup final when you want to beat the kid that or the team that's always beaten you, or it's always a close battle. We all had those in junior football. There was this... I grew up in a place called Beacon Hill in Sydney. We had Wakehurst. They always bloody beat us, Wakehurst. Home of Lucas Neal. Mm. He actually played as a striker, Lucas Neal. The opposition. Things changed for him a little bit down the years.
Any good as a striker?
Yeah, he was a big bastard. He was hard to get the ball off. But you always had that team and you always had that incentive to want to go right. Mm. You knew on the Monday or the Tuesday, you looked at the draw and you go, oh, crikey, we're playing them this weekend. This is going to be big. And you're thinking about it all week. That's as a 10-year-old kid.
Yeah.
My kid looking at it now, he doesn't have that. He's got training three times a week, and then they play on the weekend against a generic team, and then they play and they don't keep score and there's no table. Do you remember those days fondly, or do you look back on them and go, geez, I could have done without that?
Well those days, for me, were gold. I'll never forget those days. And I remember playing for my junior team, Croatia Deakin. It was they were called back then Canberra. FC now, and we from pretty much under 10s to under 14s, we were always finishing second. And there was that one team, Bell South.
Yeah.
We just couldn't get past them. And I'll never forget coming up against a team with Michael Bevan in it.
The cricketer.
The cricketer used to play for Western Creek.
Yeah.
Now, Bevan was lightning. Yeah. He was lightning. And I will never forget the lead up to those games during the week, the parents at training saying, "How the hell are we going to stop Bevan? We got to stop Bevan on the weekend. He's quick."
He's like Zidane with Messi a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. Was it the Bernabeu?
So we had this team, Western Creek, and it was all about Bevan, you know.
Bevan-centric.
You know, the parents would put a lot of pressure on us, basically saying, "Look, this is an important game. Bevan's a dangerous player. We can't allow ourselves to draw or lose against this side because we're challenging for the title. We want to we want to get past Bell South." Yeah, and those days, I mean, clearly it's, everyone sort of has a different situation or what sort of coaches you're involved with. I had coaches that put a lot of pressure on us, but I had no issue with it, you know. As a kid, it was just normal.
Yeah.
And pretty much went through sort of the next batch of coaches, like Les Scheinflack, like the late Eddie Thompson. I mean, these guys were ruthless, you know. And
so that helped you. Those formative days helped you when you got to a certain stage.
It helped me because as a player, I used to put myself under pressure anyway to perform well. But just that external pressure as well, sort of, I felt, took me to the next level. And the thing is, it was balanced too. It wasn't just coaches just yelling and shouting at players and saying, "We have to win, we have to win." There was a balance to it. And I felt the balance was perfect. And just growing up in that environment, I felt it really did help me in later years.
How do they do things in Germany?
Well, look...
their youth.
Yeah.
In... What's the structure of competitions for a 10-year-old?
Well, I mean, everyone knows what happened with Germany, obviously, the issues that they had at senior level in early 2000 and restructuring the whole junior development system. But I'll never forget sitting down with an ex-teammate of mine, Matthias Sammer, when he got the director of football role at the German Federation in 2008, and basically asked him, "Look, what do you want to do with these kids, you know? What's your goal?" Well, he basically said, "Look, we clearly want to improve their technical ability. We want technical players. We want players with silky skills. And I'm focusing as well on..." Everyone knows about our winning mentality here in Germany, but I'm not happy with it. Yeah, I'm not happy with it at the moment. I want us to get to that level where we once were. So he looked at it as basically as producing these skillful players, which is hugely important, the decision makers, the guys that can make the difference, but also having guys in the team with a strong winning mentality, guys that help the individualists because they're a bit different, yeah. So we want to build players' personality, their character, their winning mentality. We want to discuss things with them. We want to bring them in and basically make them feel that they are important. So I found it fascinating. And it pretty much turned out exactly the way he wanted it. I mean, a year later, they won the European Championships at every single level. So... it was, but there was, what I felt there as well was there was just a pressure, this external pressure on players. "Look, we want to play well, but results are hugely important too."
So they're trying to build teams rather than players. I get that out of that. Their philosophy is to build a team rather than roll our players off the end of a production line and go, "Okay, what do we do with them now?" Is that a fair statement?
It is, but that they obviously realised, you know, that football was becoming different in the way that teams set themselves up, and you know, Germany for example, 2010 was the best example, were playing some of the best counter-attacking football we've ever seen.
Yeah.
And for them, it was important to basically have sort of things in place to deal with situations in the game. We want a team that has players that can break down pack defences.
Yep.
Yeah. Because that's what you're going to get. But there's going to be games as well where we have to hurt teams on the counter attack.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the pathway that they took, and it worked out brilliantly for them.
Do they have a curriculum over there? A booklet that they give to anyone?
No.
It's all done through coach education, face to face coach education.
Well, I mean, they set out basically what sort of system they want to play, and you know that they were using the sweeper system for a long time, playing through the back, and then all of a sudden you got this switch to 4-4-2, 4-2-3-1, which they use these days. So it basically just came down to, for them, what was important was developing technical ability, the individuals, the players, and realizing that once we've achieved that in improving the technical ability of players and having those with the winning mentality, put that together and we're building great teams.
Kids in Australia, they've got so many more opportunities with so many different sports, and not saying that's not the case in Germany. I know Germany are so confident and able in so many other sports, but out here it's like summer hits and they all want to go out and play cricket and surfing. You played a lot of cricket as a kid as well. Winter hits, you got 17 different sports on a weekend that are on television that can drag your attention. You got the skate park down the road. You got bikes that you can ride outside in the middle of winter because it's still 20 degrees. It's, I don't know, what I'm getting at is, is our environment over here hindering us at all, or does it actually help kids as opposed to the ones in Europe?
Well, look, summer holidays, school holidays, for me, you know, it was pretty much 6 weeks of just playing sport every day. So half the day was playing football and the other half was playing cricket. That's what I did as a kid. But yeah. I was outdoors. I was constantly on the go, active. And automatically, you know, you're on the move and you're working on coordination, you're sprinting, you're doing all these things, yeah? I don't know, these days I just don't see many kids out there being active and doing these sorts of things. It might be the case, but maybe I'm just not in the right areas to see it.
Well, you're not outside playing cricket six hours a day these days, so... Is that true?
No,
I'd be surprised if you were.
That's true, yeah. But, I mean, with regards to, I mean, obviously, you know, with regards to my boy, it's a, I guess he has a bonus because I can sort of give him tips and correct his mistakes. But I feel that kids at that age, they really do soak up information easily. So that's why I feel that a lot more of sort of correcting errors and giving kids tips and really coaching them at a younger age won't be detrimental. I mean, you know, quite the opposite.
Coaching them mentally, not only just physically in terms of, open yourself up, first touch, one-on-one, that, it's upstairs as well.
Well, I mean, the thing is, you know, I mean, I watch a lot of junior football and it's easy for me to rock up to a game or say a training session and just spend half an hour correcting errors. But automatically what you're doing is you're helping kids to basically do the things that, you know, they were doing wrong to do them better. And then automatically they enjoy the game a lot more as well, you know. So I really do feel that we have to really put a lot into targeting that younger age group. And I just had the feeling as well, these days, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, you're out and about quite a bit as well. That it's sort of an environment that caters more for kids that just want to have fun. Yeah, I mean, you've got the kids that obviously have a lot of potential. There's always a difference, isn't there?
Yeah.
To when you watch a game, there's a few players where you think, well, these kids actually might have a future in the game. So are we doing enough to cater for them as well?
What I think has happened is that the 9 to 12 age group is all about the training, and it's not so much about the games, because the games in the area we are in Sydney, they went from a couple of years ago, we were travelling all over Sydney. I didn't mind going out to all these wonderful grounds. We went out to Adenza Park one day. We went to Bonnyrigg. We went all the way to Nowra as well occasionally. And then they changed it. They went, no, it's too much on the parents. Let's regionalise it within Sydney. And now we don't travel more than 45 minutes away. I didn't mind the hour and a half trip out to MacArthur or whatever. But now it's, no, you've got to play in your area. Now we're at a strong club where there's a lot, well, the concentration of kids isn't as diluted, so you're picking the kids that you pick are better, basically. They're the ones that stand out, as opposed to a smaller area when you don't have that huge catchment area. So it's just a force of numbers. So they changed it to make it regionalised, to make it, I don't know, I guess it was saving petrol bills on for parents on a weekend, making it easier for them. So they've said that for 9 to 12, and then they go to 13 onwards, under 13 onwards, youth league, and then it becomes Sydney-wide again. You play at Div 1, you play against the best teams. But my question is, does that sound dangerous that these kids from 9 to 12 who are in the skill acquisition phase, apparently, as opposed to game management and all those things that come a bit later, should they be playing against the best of the best at that age? Or is it fair enough that they're just playing against whoever they are on a weekend and you focus more on training?
No, I believe that they should be playing against the best. Mm. Don't you think so?
I would think that you become better by playing against the best. You get more out of yourself. Yeah. So,
You've got to challenge kids.
Yeah.
Even at that age. And I believe it's hugely important. But, you know, I mean, the thing that I don't get, I mean, there's a lot of people talking about the curriculum. And when I say overemphasis, do you really think that we're going to produce world-class players because we're doing stuff from a curriculum? I mean, is it that easy to produce players, you know?
Well, I'll throw it back at you. Would you have made it as a player, the standard that you made, which was the very, very, very top, if you didn't, say, go to the AIS? Do you reckon?
Well,
we're talking about elite environments now, bringing it back to that. Yeah. That was the elite environment, especially back in the late 80s when you were there and early 90s.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, so I went there when I was 16. Mm. Yeah. So all the work really, with regards to my junior development, the technical stuff and all that, had already been done.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the thing is, if the ball was bouncing off my shins, what would the AIS have taken me and said, "Hey, look, this guy, he's not bad.
We can fix this.
We can fix it." Yeah, yeah. And it's the same example. I mean, look at Messi. I mean, he went to La Masia at age of 12.
Yeah.
But he was bloody good at 12, wasn't he? Or else they wouldn't have taken him.
No.
Yeah?
No.
Yeah. So, I mean, the things that I learnt, obviously, at the AIS with Ron Smith and Gary Cole, still a lot of things stick out in my mind, just sort of dealing with in tight situations, finding solutions and those sorts of things. But I just had the feeling as well, you know, when Ron sort of looked at me and Gary Cole as well, and they talked to me a lot as well. It gave me a lot of information and stuff like that, which I really did treasure. And just the tactical side to the game, where I learnt a lot. But they gave me freedom as well to really express myself. And sure, they had a way that they wanted to play, but still they looked at the players and basically said, wow, you know, this guy's good. If I have to change something with my philosophy to sort of suit him, which makes our team better, then so be it, you know. So there was a lot of flexibility there.
Did they take Michael Bevan? Or did he move on to cricket?
I think he moved on to cricket, yeah.
He dug it off. It worked out okay for him as well. Remember that night at the SCG? Did you take solace in the fact that you had a part to do with his development that night when they beat the Windies on the last ball of the day?
Because you thought
he wouldn't have done that if we didn't give it to them when we were under 14s. He was mentally strong in that occasion because he was so
demoralised losing against us. He thought, you know what, stuff this, I'm going to take up cricket.
Hey, at the moment, at every level, you got you can break it down, can't you? You've got the discovery phase. They call it the discovery phase, which is the phase that Tom Beyer was talking about when he was on your shootout show a few weeks ago, about a month ago now. As soon as the kid can walk, give them a ball. That's the discovery phase. The discovery phase shouldn't start when they're four or five, when they want to go down and have a kick with their mates on a weekend from school. And then they move to skill acquisition, 9 to 12. And then it's youth league and onwards. So they're segmented that all the way to now. The elite don't have that centre of excellence. I think the way the FFA were thinking a couple of weeks ago when they made the decision is, hey, the A-League clubs now are your 10. You've got, or in Australia, 9 centre of excellences around the place. That should be their place to go, and we can build a higher quality, a bigger number of elite players, if you like. That way of thinking, is, do you get that, or do you look at the centre of excellence with rose-coloured glasses and go, no, that should still be the ultimate finishing school for Australian football?
Well, yeah, it should be, and it was. But, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, are the best players still going there these days?
Well, no, some of them turn them down because they became billeted out.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. And see, that's the thing that's probably bothered me the most with what's happened, the fact that parents basically had to make a decision, look, am I going to send my kid to Canberra and he's going to be living with people I basically don't know, you know, with strangers? And is that the environment that I want for my kid? Or if there is the possibility of him staying at home and playing at a club nearby and still getting good development, I mean, you know.
That happened.
So when you're faced with that decision, it's
That happened because they cut the government funding. They downgraded the sport from a tier B, I think it was. Kate Cohen wrote it on foxsports.com.au a couple of weeks ago, down to a tier C. So that's what happened with that. It was sad, but it's kind of like a river, the riverbed. It's changing all the time. It's shifting around.
Yeah, look, I always believe that it's still the centre of excellence had a role to play. And just providing kids with that really professional environment was hugely important. I don't know. I feel it's a bit drastic to Canada. I thought maybe you could have let it go a bit longer and sort of said, look, we're going to give you an opportunity, but we need to see results. And I mean, is it fair to say no one's happy with the results that...
How could you be?
Exactly. So the thing is, something has to be done. Something had to be corrected. And I just feel that the move is a bit drastic. We'll see what happens down the track, I guess.
It's a hard one because with the curriculum, it came in 2009, I think it was first implemented, and then it's been a couple of variations or one variation since. So these kids in 09, which hit it, in the skill acquisition phase, if you want, under 9s, 10s, and now the ones that are at the centre of excellence, and you don't know if they're going to be epic professional players because they're not at that stage yet. We'll know in a couple of years' time. It is the great unknown, what's going to come off the production line. How did they know, say, in a place like Germany? Is it because the football culture is that bigger over there? And I get back to the fact that we get splintered here. All our best athletes go off in all kinds of different directions. Whereas if you're a male and you're a great athlete, invariably in Germany, I dare say, unless your hero's Boris Becker, you're going to end up in football 9 times out of 10 or maybe 7 times out of 10. How are they so sure that their production line, when they had a shift of thinking about a decade ago or even more so, that was going to definitely work? Because from where I sit, there's still a great amount of uncertainty as to what this curriculum and what this style of youth development is going to produce in the end.
I mean, with this skills acquisition program that they basically brought in after that, and I believe they had about 380 of them across the whole country. So
380 skills.
So you're basically basically the furthest you had to drive, I believe, was about 20 kilometres. Anywhere in Germany to get to one. And I spent some time there because I was doing the coaching license over there. So it was part of the coaching license to actually attend these programs, which was every Monday night. So once a week for the kids it was.
Yep.
And they were still obviously playing for their clubs, but they'd meet up on Monday.
Yep.
And that was like sort of the that selection thing going, so sort of the best they were getting as well. And these were kids that were not involved with Bundesliga clubs or second division as well.
So those kids have already been picked off.
So these kids...
The Bundesliga ones that are
already I mean, to explain it, it's basically the kids that weren't picked by Bundesliga clubs.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's the next tier down.
In their academies. Yeah.
And to be honest with you, I mean, I was there probably about 15 times. Mm. Yeah. So 15 weeks. And there were a few times I was thinking, you know, there's some decent kids here, but it's really nothing special, you know. And they really are investing a lot of money into this.
Yeah.
But I think the big difference was... just the work of the clubs, what they had to do. I mean, they had to basically build a training centre for these kids.
So these are regional clubs that are playing in the regional
tiers
in German football, so third, fourth, fifth division.
But the big difference is just the work of the clubs, what they're doing, the fact that they've just invested in these centres. I mean, and the facilities are just amazing.
Yeah.
I was at a club last September, it was, just before the A-League started. I was over there, Darmstadt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
About to be pinged from Bundesliga.
Yeah. I mean, they expected it, but I was talking to a guy there who's a junior director. He was actually at Eintracht Frankfurt when I was playing there. And he was showing me around the place, and it was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know? Just the facilities for these kids, you know? They have a full-time physio. They've got doctors. You know, for 11, 12-year-olds, do you know what I mean? It's like, and just the grounds as well, and it was amazing. It was amazing. So kids have it all there, basically. No excuses. And they provide the best coaches as well. So
do they put heat on them
to
perform in these training sessions?
They do.
Is there
they
a bit
do.
Of yelling going on and saying home truths?
Oh, yeah. Well, especially when you're playing for these types of clubs. So you've got the Darmstadt's in that area, Mainz, for example, Eintracht Frankfurt. So these clubs come up against some of the regional teams as well, you know. And it's like, hey, we're meant to win these games, you know. So there's a lot of pressure there on the kids. And you've got situations as well. I was at Mainz as well for a couple of weeks where, you know, kids will come in there. They'll be selected to play for the under-10s, 11s. If it's not good enough, then it's, you know, the next one comes in and you have to leave. So it's a ruthless environment.
So those ones were the elite ones. So they're 40, 50 elite academies that are around Germany. And then below that, you've got the 380 centres. Is that what you're saying?
You've got the clubs that have their own juniors.
Yeah.
Yeah. So none of their kids are involved in rocking up there on a Monday night.
Yeah.
That's basically left for the other kids that haven't been selected by professional clubs. Yeah.
And they go out and train there once a week, and then they go back to
their regional
village teams.
Exactly right. Yeah. Exactly right.
Wow. What kind of rules do they play over there? Because here at that age, it's you're not allowed to. There's a exclusion zone playing out. So from 20 metres into the goal, if it goes out for a goal kick, the goalkeeper can play out to whoever he wants to, and the kids aren't allowed to advance, opposition kids aren't allowed to advance on the other team until the first touch is taken by whoever the goalkeeper passes to. That, to me, seems like, getting back to your point about putting kids under pressure, seems counterintuitive to something like that, because that's not a realistic situation to when they play big boys football or big girls football.
Well,
it's kind of weird.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've seen a few training sessions here in Australia from different junior clubs, and I don't know, the thing that seems to lack is sort of this real game simulation. I've seen training sessions as well. They do exercises. you know, for an hour, and they don't even finish with a game, you know. So shooting and crossing and a lot of static stuff. Where I think to myself, I think to myself, if you're not going to finish a training session with a game, then you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
So I guess it's up to everyone to decide what they do and what they feel is good for the kids. But I mean, if you look at football today, it pretty much comes down to if you can produce the decision makers in the game, not just attackers or offensive midfield players. Look at the defenders as well. These guys are making a difference. I mean, just watching Urawa Reds. You look at the way they play the game. You know, I mean, everyone's went through that phase of short passing and tiki taka and this and that. But look at these guys, the way they mix it up. And how dangerous a long pass from the back can be if it's pinpoint and find someone that's running in behind the defence. I mean, for me, the perfect mix of football. So you've got to look at producing those sorts of players that can build up from the back, that are comfortable on the ball. I think Trent Sainsbury was a great example during the Asian Cup. I mean, the amount of times that he was playing those balls, you know, through the lines. And that's the sort of thing you've got to focus on, I believe, at training.
Here's the fun thing then. Would it surprise you, shock you, sadden you, or you don't care, the fact that in about 4 years of watching this kind of training, I've never seen them practice long passes.
Really, yeah?
Long passes, like 30-metre ones. Yeah. And I know they're 9 to 12-year-olds, but does that worry you a little?
It does. Yeah, it does.
Okay.
Because it basically turns your game into being completely predictable. Yeah. So the opponent basically knows, well, these guys, they're just going to try and play out, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're just going to try and hurt us with their short passing game and try to play through us. Yeah.
With your experience, what would you say your key age where it kind of clicked, where everything kind of started to make sense about your football was? In your development? I don't know if you can remember those, because you live it and you go through it and then you look back on it and I don't know if you can remember a period of time, whether it be because of a coach or because it started to work upstairs and it was in synchronicity with the rest of your body, or vice versa, your mind caught up later. I don't know. Was there an age where it kind of clicked and you thought, what I've been told, what I've been taught, what I'm teaching myself is now starting to pay off a bit?
Yeah. I think the biggest thing for me looking back now was, and I started off as a striker, so I was scoring like 25, 30, 40 goals a season, you know, in those early junior years.
Did you take your shirt off after one of the best ones and twirl it above your head? Go to the court. Take that, Bevan! Face.
I should have, actually. Now that you mentioned, I should have.
Regrets, everyone has them.
So I was a striker right up until age 15, and then slowly started to work my way back. was then a number 10 offensive midfielder. Then I was just a central midfielder, number 8, getting up and back, up and back. And then it all changed when I went to the institute. Where the coaches felt during that year, well, it was actually towards the end of that year, that I would be a great attacking sweeper. Yeah. And they put me back there and
attacking sweeper.
And just told me, look, get the ball off the keeper and just go pass players.
Yeah? Just run.
Just run. Just run. You're quick. And that's what I did. Yeah. And that's where it all changed for me, really, was pretty much finding a position where I could really show my full potential.
Yeah.
And that was the case there. And then really it all happened from there. I mean, obviously there were ups and downs, you know. I remember moving away from the institute to go and play for Sydney Croatia back then in the NSL, and being hugely unhappy and having pretty much a terrible season where I didn't kick on as a player, and deciding after that season to pretty much go back home, go back to Canberra, back to the State League, where everyone thought, well, that's it, Zelich is done, he's finished. And then I actually remember rocking up because Tommy Somani was the coach then.
Yeah.
And the first few training sessions with me, and he turned around and said, "Mate, you're a mess physically, mentally. What's happened to you?" And he goes, "Don't worry, we're going to fix this." After 3 months, I was flying, and then called into the Oli Roos camp. Was made captain.
Yeah.
And it just showed me as well that players go through periods, are going to go through periods where they think, you know what, maybe it's all over.
Yeah.
You know, this is, how am I going to get out of this hole that I'm in, you know?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you put your head down, you work harder, and things happen. So, looking back now, I mean, I wouldn't change anything. You know, even the mistakes I made back then, just keep them, you know, because it really did help me and made me stronger.
Interesting you mentioned about the shuffling of positions around. Is it fair enough that kids play in different positions, as many different positions as possible in their formative years? I'm saying from 9 to, say, I don't know, 15, 16. I wouldn't want to put a cap on it. It changes all the time. Look at Jason Hoffman. In the past 2 years, he's played left-back, right-back, striker, number 10. So,
yeah.
And that's in a professional environment. Is there a rule that you see that should be kind of where you guide yourself by as a coach or whatever to say that, no, this kid kind of looks like one thing, so keep him there or her, or shuffle him around?
I mean, I don't agree with too much shuffling around, but a few adjustments here and there.
Hmm.
I don't see any issues with that. I mean, I can't see a right back all of a sudden playing up front or the other way around, sort of thing. You know, it's a bit too drastic, but it certainly helped me because. I mean, obviously, I didn't play striker ever again in later years, but certainly did shuffle around quite a bit in the midfield, so in between the midfield and the back.
Didn't you go up there for the Australian Legends against the Liverpool Legends up front, or was Slater too busy barging everyone over?
Slater was too busy warming up for 60 minutes.
So we've gone everywhere with this kind of thing. There's been no set pattern. We've covered just about everything that's come into my mind. And I don't know if there's anything that you want to add about where we're headed as a football nation development-wise. But I guess the fear is that it is unknown and we don't really know. And we've seen the writing on the wall. I don't know if it is the writing on the wall or it might be the false dawn. Not sure about where we're headed given the performances of our youth national teams of late. But it's almost like we're sitting on a bit of a goldmine given the number of players that are playing the game at a junior level in Australia, but we're still not quite sure what to do with the shovel to dig in to find that gold. Is that reasonable, or we just got to refine how we did it back in the day?
Mm. Well, I just think it's hugely important that that people voice their concerns. And I get the feeling that some people just carry on as if nothing's happened. You know, let's just keep doing things the way we've been doing them. It doesn't matter that we're not qualifying. Let's just stick to the plan, and down the track we'll produce players. I'm still confident that this country will produce top class players, but I really do believe that that we have to look at, obviously, the good things that we did in the past. There's no problem learning from other nations as well to see what they're doing, but I believe it's hugely important that that we sort of try to produce technical ability parallel with the traditional qualities that we've always had, and that's the will to win, the fighting spirit,
ruthlessness.
Exactly. I mean, not just football, but you see it in all sports.
Yeah.
And I speak to a lot of people around the world, and we've always had that reputation of, it doesn't matter which sporting team you come up against from Australia, we know that they're going to give us a tough game. So yeah. I think we can't lose track of you know, that fighting spirit that's given us so much success in the past as well.
Many layers to becoming a professional footballer, from what I notice. There's the, you build yourself up as a, with a good enough technical ability, and then you need to have the mental capabilities, and then you've got to have a bit of luck, and then you've got to be in the right team, and then you've got to be in the right place at the right time. So it's not a simple thing to say, here's the set formula to becoming a world-class footballer, but hopefully the last, what have we been sitting here for, 40 minutes or so, has given a little inclination about some of the ingredients required with someone that's been through all of that, Ned. Thank you for having the discussion. I'm not sure what entirely we accomplished here, but I had fun. Not least the story about Michael Bevan.
That's the main thing. We had fun.
Exactly. Cheers, Ned. And thanks for the discussion.
Buddy.
Cheers.